From KCRW in Santa Monica and PRI, Public Radio International, this is To the Point.
Legal highs with lethal consequences. I'm Barbara Bogave, sitting in for Warren Olney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. New York, Mississippi, and Alabama have issued health alerts after seeing a spike in overdoses from new recreational drugs. They're called legal highs, and they're chemical compounds that mimic illegal substances, but are just different enough to skirt existing laws. Many come from Chinese factories, and as soon as they're outlawed, new ones rise in their place. How to stop the global rise of recreational drug innovation. And on today's Talking Point, Starbucks promised to help its baristas finish college. PR stunt or guide to making higher education more accessible for all. First, the news.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage on our mobile app or online at kcrw.com.
Support for To the Point comes from the members of KCRW and from the Public Radio International Program Fund.
And we're back with To the Point. I'm Barbara Bogave in for Warren Olney. Just ahead, new legal chemical compounds that mimic illegal drugs like pot and cocaine are pouring into the country from labs in China and India, causing a rise in overdoses. Is legalization and regulation the answer? And later on today's Talking Point, we check in on a Starbucks program to help its employees pay for college. Has it paid off for baristas, or does the hype outweigh the results? First, this update. U.S. Attorney General Loretta Lynch announced today the launch of a sweeping investigation of the Baltimore Police Department. The probe follows the death of Freddie Gray in police custody and criminal charges filed against six officers. Baltimore officials had asked for a federal review. And Lynch said today one was needed to fix a serious erosion of public trust.
This investigation will begin immediately and will focus on allegations that Baltimore Police Department officers use excessive force, including deadly force, conduct unlawful searches, seizures, and arrests, and engage in discriminatory policing.
Gloria Brown Marshall is a professor of constitutional law at John Jay College of Criminal Justice. She's the author of Race, Law, and American Society, and it's good to have you join us.
Thank you, Barbara.
So this morning, the DOG's probe was described as a pattern or practice investigation, and the attorney general did just in our cut there lay out in broad strokes the focus it will take. But what specifically will it look at in determining whether there was a pattern or practice of civil rights violations?
Well, the pattern and practice procedure is different from one that focuses on the individual police officer. This is looking at the department as a whole to determine whether or not the training is up to par, whether or not the actions of the police officers are within the constitutional construct for the rights of the people being arrested or detained, and, of course, how long this has been going on. And that's why it's called a pattern or practice, to see not just this one incident, but if there is a history of incidents or history of police officers not working within the constraints of the law.
So how intrusive does that mean the Department of Justice will be in with the department? Will that mean lawyers will be there interrogating Baltimore police?
It will be very intrusive, and police officers dislike this with a passion. This is something that they will normally attempt to protect themselves from, but the U.S. Attorney General's office is the office of the country's highest law enforcement agent. So U.S. Attorney General Lynch has the power to go into these police departments and look at their files and question community leaders, question police officers, even do ride-alongs where they ride along with police officers to find out how they interact with the public and, of course, to determine the policies they're being taught, the training, whether or not it falls within U.S. Supreme Court decisions. Sometimes these police departments are not up to the latest U.S. Supreme Court decisions and rulings. And so those things are all going to be examined by the Attorney General's office.
Why did Baltimore officials ask for this?
Well,
given how intrusive this is and sounds, why did they want this?
Well, to be quite frank, I think because the mayor did not believe, nor the prosecutor, that they could have been, they had the power and they had the ability to be this intrusive within their own police department.
And there is some concern on the part of other mayors and that they feel this way, and they might also ask the DOG to step in. The U.S. Attorney General addressed this morning.
We cannot litigate our way out of this problem, and it is not the department's intention to engage in an investigation or review of every police department across the country. It is rather our goal and our profound hope that the work that we have done will be a base for communities to look at and to build upon as they determine what issues exist in their communities.
Do you hear a message? It sounds like a message there to other police departments. What is the Attorney General saying?
There's a deep message. I mean, there were tensions in New York City between the new mayor, who was thought to be a reformer, Mayor de Blasio, and the police department that under the former mayors had, you know, a great deal more authority than this mayor wants them to have. There are long-going tensions between a reformist mayor and maybe the old-school, quote-unquote, police departments. And so this message is the Attorney General's office does not have the resources nor the time to investigate every jurisdiction in need of investigation. So this is going to send a message to those police departments. First and foremost, we will come for you. And second, we don't want to. We want you to be able to look at the report and recommendations that come from this investigation and then change accordingly so that we don't have to have an investigation of that particular police department.
And to put this in the bigger context, how will this investigation compare to the one in Ferguson, say?
Well, this investigation is similar to the one in Ferguson, but once again, they found a pattern in practice in Ferguson, but it didn't go to the extent of the police, the individual behavior of the police or individual police officers. And actually, we look more so to the L.A. investigation in Rodney King. People are very familiar with that and how there were long-term changes made. And there have been changes, we've been told, made in Ferguson.
Gloria Brown Marshall, professor of constitutional law at John Jay College of Criminal Justice and author of the book Race, Law, and American Society, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us today.
Thank you.
And when we come back, legal highs with deadly consequences from Chinese factories to your local head shop. Stay with us for that conversation on To the Point.
Are you thinking about buying a new car? Consider donating your old one to KCRW and support the unique mix of news, music, and culture you love. You'll become a KCRW member and get a nice tax write-off. For details, visit kcrw.com/cars.
KCRW thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com.
It's To the Point. I'm Barbara Bogave in for Warren Olney. They call them legal highs, or in the acronym-driven drug lingo, NPS, novel psychoactive substances. They're drugs that mimic the highs of banned substances like marijuana or cocaine, but their chemistry has been tinkered with just enough that they fall through the cracks of international drug control laws. Since about 2009, they've been flooding the market with at times deadly results. Last month, New York, Mississippi, and Alabama issued health alerts after a rash of overdoses, and police in Tuscaloosa, Alabama, declared a public health crisis when one person died and two dozen were hospitalized after taking an NPS known on the street as spice. Nicola Davison writes for The Guardian. She joins us from Shanghai. Welcome to the show.
Hi there. Hi.
So many of these labs producing the drugs are in China, and you visited a few of these drug labs in Shanghai. Are they just what you'd expect from a laboratory, white coats and sterile conditions?
Not exactly, no. I went into a number of labs, and I feel like I got a sense of the spectrum. And so on one side, you have a more professional outfit with white coats and very high technology and a lot of diligence in terms of synthesis. And on the other end, you have much more sketchy outfits, filthy labs with chemicals whirring in the background and and plastic, you know, rubber gloves sort of discarded all over surfaces and powder all over the floor.
Well, so run the gamut. Well, what did the chemist you were dealing with know about the potential toxicity of these chemicals that they were working with?
The chemist wanted to emphasize to me, and I was posing as, you know, I was undercover and posing as a vendor of these substances, so someone that would import them into the US or the UK. And to me, they weren't really willing to talk about the effects that the drugs could potentially have. They just were chemists, you know, they were Chinese scientists who had gone through university and were doing this, you know, legally.
Right. And what were you were posing as a vendor, so what were you in the market for? What drug were you asking about?
I was asking about a substance which is a synthetic cannabinoid called AB Comenica, which is legal at the moment in the UK but was banned in the US in December last year. And as a cannabinoid, it affects the central nervous system in the same or a similar way to marijuana or cannabis.
And they said, yes, we got it. We got it, no problem.
I decided to, I sort of picked this particular chemical, this particular legal high, out of 100 or so that I could have picked. And it was very easy to find dozens of labs who were willing to synthesize huge, huge amounts of this drug.
Nicola Davison writes for The Guardian. Mark Ryan is director of the Louisiana Poison Center. So when did you first start seeing drugs like our guest Nicola Davison is talking about, these legal high drugs showing up in your state?
Well, the first reports in the United States City Poison Centers occurred in the summer of 2009. Had just a couple of reports in a few states, and then it rapidly progressed through the end of 2009 into 2010 to covering every state in the United States.
Yeah, and I said earlier, and you're saying that they've just flooded the U.S. market, and right now spice is one of the drugs we're hearing about. How many cases are you seeing from spice?
Well, the poison centers peaked in 2011 with, I want to say, about 7,000 cases. And the numbers to the poison centers look like they're going down a little bit, but those numbers kind of don't really tell the whole story. They've been out long enough now that many of the physicians are more comfortable with what they're seeing and how to treat them, so they don't call us quite as much. They call us for the really severe ones and the unique ones, which may indicate a brand new substance that's out there. But from talking to law enforcement, this problem is still extremely real.
So that's what we're maybe seeing with spice?
Yeah, and, you know, spice is one of those terms. Spice and K2 were the first of the, quote, name brands, I guess, if you will, that came out in 2009. And in different geographic areas of the country, there's a kind of a generic name that's used to kind of describe that whole realm of cannabinoids. Here in the southern part of Louisiana, everything, it doesn't matter what they take, usually they come into the emergency department and they say they took Mojo. So it's different in different areas, but same drugs.
And how fast did these new drugs evolve to keep one step ahead of the law?
Well, we're getting better. But when they originally came out, they were basically legal. And that's how they were touted, as, you know, legal highs and not detectable on drug tests. So young working people, especially fresh out of college in that 24 to, say, 30, 32 range, were the predominant age range of users. Now we've seen, we had an exposure, it was inadvertent, but down here in one less than a year old, and we've seen them up in their 70s. So it's the entire spectrum now.
And it goes by the name of synthetic marijuana or synthetic pot, at least in the media. But how accurate is that? How similar chemically and in terms of the effect and potency are these drugs to pot?
Well, when you talk about marijuana, the two major active ingredients are THC and cannabidiol. These drugs are said to be synthetic marijuana, but they're really not. I mean, you could create synthetic THC in a lab. That's possible. These drugs are better termed as cannabimimetics or synthetic cannabinoids. They're meant to act like marijuana, but they also have effects on other neurotransmitters in our body, chemicals that cause reactions like dopamine, serotonin, norepinephrine. and they can cause massive changes in those neurotransmitters in a very short period of time, which helps to explain some of the paranoia, the psychosis, the excited delirium, the bizarre behavior that we've seen in many of the people who have used these substances.
Mark Ryan, director of the Louisiana Poison Center. Nicola Davison writes for The Guardian, and she joins us from Shanghai. What can you tell us about this supply chain for these drugs? How do they move from Chinese labs to a place like Louisiana?
Well, vendors who are based in the U.S. or in Europe will put in orders with these labs, and the labs just churn out the drugs, and the ones I spoke to would then divide the order into, they preferred 1 kilo packages because they were more easily transferred through international courier, such as FedEx or DHL. And they just arrive at the vendor's doorstep through the post.
That easy. Nicola Davison writes for The Guardian. Danny Kushlick, head of external affairs at Transform, a British drug reform, joins us now. That's a drug reform think tank. Excuse me. Welcome to the program.
Okay.
It sounds as if the moment that the moment the government makes one of these new legal high drugs illegal, a new one sprouts up to take its place. So what are the alternatives? How to deal with this situation, with what Alabama is calling a public health crisis?
Well, you're absolutely right. I mean, the descriptions of both Mark and Nicola are very clear in terms of the effects of these things and where they originate from. But let's be absolutely clear that the legal highs are a product of prohibition itself, in the same way that moonshine was a product of the alcohol prohibition.
Do you mean here I can't get my pot or I can't get Coke, so I'm going to buy this drug because it's easier? It's at hand.
It's available. Once you push something underground, there will be other substances, particularly if you make it difficult to get hold of. It's just called the UN Office on Drugs and Crime calls it substance displacement. It's a well recognized phenomenon. And if you push alcohol, legal alcohol, out the way, then people will distill moonshine, some of which will be very dangerous and will kill people and will blind them. This is exactly the same. We know this. And the tragedy of this is that we knew this from alcohol prohibition, and yet we've repeated this on a global stage with currently prohibited drugs. And the clear answer, what got rid of moonshine, or pretty much got rid of it, was re-legalizing alcohol. Not because alcohol is great, it's a poison, as Mark, I'm sure, will tell us. But the point is that it's better to have it legal and regulated by states and governments than it is to through substance displacement, to push it into the hands of organized criminals and unregulated dealers.
And I want to get a chance, give a chance to Mark Ryan to respond to this, but just to be clear, what then are you advocating become legalized? Marijuana?
Well, what we'd say is that you legalize and regulate for people over the age of 18, and you dispense them from pharmacies or you sell them from licensed outlets. Drugs that we, with the traditional drugs that we know their effects, that the users have long, sometimes in the case of some drugs like cocaine and heroin, opiates and cannabis, many hundreds of years experience of using these things. And it doesn't mean that they're safe, but it means that we know from a public health point of view, from a public policy point of view, and from a consumer's point of view how these things work. And if we make these legally available under strict control and regulation, the NPS market, the legal highs market, will disappear. People don't want to use unknown, untested, where there's no product information, no safer use guide. You know, some of these things are just sold as bath salts or plant food. And people will go back to the ones that they know, understand, and that will ultimately keep people safer.
Danny Kushlick, head of external affairs at Transform, a British drug reform think tank. Mark Ryan, director of the Louisiana Poison Center. Is that true? Is this substance displacement something that always happens, and that people will not go looking for these new psychoactive drugs that are unregulated if they have regulated, reliable ones at their disposal? Or are people always looking for a new high?
It's an interesting thought. And if you look at states here in the U.S. where marijuana is legal, California and more recently Colorado, this problem is still very much alive and well in those states. What it appears to me, and it's befuddled me now since it really started here, is that those other drugs, that's true. Some of them, they're regulated. Some of them very tightly controlled. And they're still available on the street in massive quantities, very easy to obtain. It seems as though people are shooting for the newest, greatest, biggest, never-been-tried-before high that they can find. And that's very true. We know what methamphetamine is. We know what cocaine is. They've been around for a very long time, so we know what they do. But there's now over 300 different cannabinoids that we know that are out there. And these have never been tested on anything. So I do agree that if the FDA went through the process and these companies went through that regulatory process and the FDA deemed it to be a drug that had some medicinal use, it's a totally different story. But I don't believe that's ever going to happen, especially with these type drugs.
Who are the people that come into the ER after using these drugs? Before we talk more about legalization or not, who are they and how old are they? And is there a class issue here? And does that figure into the policy of into drug policy?
You know, it really seems to cross all classes. They're easily available, whether it's off the internet. You can buy it in packet size all the way up to kilo size. That's very true. You can buy it in the, not out of displayed anymore, but under the counter in the back room of some convenience stores, smoke shops. We know that's still very, very possible. But it's across the board, the people who come into the ER. Now, what's really interesting about the severity of these things, from a poison control standpoint, on any given day, any poison center across the country, about 20% of our calls come from hospital emergency departments asking for our help to manage a poisoned or overdose patient. Other 80% mainly home. With these drugs, 95%+ of the calls related to them come from the hospitals. There are not people at home who used these, had a mild reaction, and called us and said, hey, am I going to be okay? They are people who have used these things literally going off the deep end, off the edge, sometimes calling the police on themselves, please come get me. You know, relatives, they've hurt themselves, they've hurt someone else, they've done something really crazy, and they end up in the ICU, sometimes for days.
Well, how is Louisiana handling this? Well, what's happening in your state regarding regulation?
Well, what we've done is when they originally came out, we had never seen these before. So it was difficult to try and identify them. So we gathered packets. We sent them to the crime labs. They, in some cases, had never seen them before. So they had to go to another chemical company to make a sample, a pure sample, to test against. Now what we try to do is test numerous samples. And every time that we find something new and we also see from either samples taken from the person or blood, urine, serum samples taken from that person and tested, if there's one that's causing a problem, Louisiana now uses what's called emergency rule.
And we're going to talk more about that when we come back after the break. Mark Ryan with the Louisiana Poison Center. After this short break, we're going to continue our conversation about the rise of the legal high drug trade and whether legalization makes things safer or just inspires more abuse. And later on our talking point, Starbucks is helping its baristas get a college education. That's coming up on To The Point from PRI.
KCRW's Eclectic 24 is our ever-expanding all-music stream featuring the best new releases, classic favorites, and special features, including today's top tune, guest DJ project, and KCRW archives. Listen worldwide anytime online or through your iPhone or Android phone app. KCRW's Eclectic 24, where and when you want it. Check it out at kcrw.com/eclectic24.
And we're back with To The Point. I'm Barbara Bogave in for Warren Olney. If you're just joining us, we're talking about the rise of novel psychoactive drugs, or NPSs, otherwise known as new legal highs. They're drugs produced from legal chemicals, typically made in China and India in labs, and they're designed to mimic the effects of banned substances like marijuana or cocaine. Last month, New York, Mississippi, and Alabama issued health alerts about NPSs after a slew of overdoses from spice, synthetic cannabinoid. Maya Salovitz is the author of the forthcoming book, Unbroken Brain, Why Addiction is a Learning Disorder and Why It Matters. And she joins us now. Good to have you on the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
So why have so many of these legal psychoactive drugs hit the market in recent years?
I actually want to strongly disagree with the prior guest regarding Colorado and Washington and the presence of these legal highs. Basically, these are out there for two reasons. We've got the internet, which allows you to hook up with Chinese labs, and you've got drug prohibition, which basically makes substances that people want to take illegal.
So by disagreement, you're saying that there isn't an issue in Colorado even after...
I'm saying we don't have any data.
Ah, okay.
Because I do not believe that that has been collected.
Okay, and how does globalization fit into this? I mean, clearly the internet, you can just, you know, click link and you've made contact and you can order something, I assume. But
well, what happened with these is that there's always been a small group of people who is willing to experiment with the newest, hippest highs. These people tend to be interested in psychedelic drugs. And they came together online and created these communities, and they realized they could just order new things. So then people started to realize, aha, there's a market for this. So then it spread outward from there. But the original people who were doing this were kind of like the original people who took LSD. And they are sort of a small, educated group of people that is just really interested in various degrees of mind altering. This is sort of different from somebody who's interested in, say, heroin or cocaine. Heroin and cocaine and marijuana have stuck around for thousands of years. The reason we sort of get this new hip drug thing is in large part due to the media.
Maya Salovitz, author of the forthcoming book, Unbroken Brain. Mark Ryan with the Louisiana Poison Center. Does that jive with what you were saying earlier, that really the people that are calling your center and going to ER, they come from across, they spread the gamut?
They absolutely spread the gamut. And we're seeing people who, are on the street. Some are who are the very lowest strata of the socioeconomic level coming in, just as many as we see. This isn't cocaine in the 1970s where it's a rich man's toy. And as far as the previous speaker there in Colorado, if she would check with her state police crime labs and the poison center there in Colorado, she'd find that it is a very serious problem there in that state also.
Okay, Mark Ryan with the Louisiana Poison Center. Maya Salovitz, how well or poorly is law enforcement and the DEA dealing with then this rapid rise of these products?
Well, the UN Drug Control Agency admitted a few years ago that they cannot deal with this and that this has posed an unprecedented threat to the current drug control regime because it is decentralized, it's globalized, and it's really impossible to deal with what is essentially a health problem by trying to do law enforcement.
And in terms of how big a health problem this is, what percentage of these drugs are more dangerous than the illicit substances that they mimic?
Well, we don't know. And the reality is that a lot of people who take these things are trying to avoid being drug tested. A lot of people who take them, absolutely, if you survey these people, they will say, I would much prefer to smoke pot. And in Colorado, there remains the case that people still get drug tested at work.
So that speaks to the prohibition angle on this.
Yes. And I mean, the other thing is that a poison control center has a very select sample of people that it sees, i.e. the tiny group of people that gets in severe, extreme trouble. They do not see the people who just take this and go on with their lives. So it's hard to tell what is affecting the biases that exist in that sample.
Well, you are in recovery from using cocaine, also heroin. What's your perspective on then the allure of these drugs and why people are interested in them?
There is a huge variance in that. In my own personal case, I was very socially isolated and had a really just sort of a great fear of people. So for me, it was self-medication. There's certainly, for teenagers who are not addicted, it just seems like something interesting and daring to do. But only 10 to 15% of people who try drugs like cocaine, heroin, and alcohol actually get addicted. And there tends to be several characteristics that distinguish those people. About 50% tend to have a mental illness. Two-thirds tend to have extreme childhood trauma. And there's also a proportion that has a personality disorder called antisocial personality disorder. So it's just such a wide-ranging thing that you can't just say, well, there's one reason. Like, why do people drink? You're talking about Starbucks in your next section. You know, it's sort of historical randomness that we ended up having Starbucks rather than cocaine-sniffing shops.
given the, at one point, cocoa was our drug, and then caffeine. Yeah.
Well, we actually had it in Coca-Cola. There
Absolutely.
Was cocaine.
Maya Salavitz, author of the forthcoming book Unbroken Brain, Why Addiction is a Learning Disorder and Why It Matters. Just one more question while we're talking about this. Then would it have made such a difference in your life if the legalization that our guest that we're going to speak with next, Danny Kushlick, had gone through and that you had more legal options to draw from?
I think what would have made a difference is understanding that I had mental health problems very early on. I think there's a very interesting new program in terms of drug prevention, and it doesn't focus on drugs at all. It focuses on impulsivity and on anxiety and on hopelessness. And the way we're going to stop this problem is by recognizing that people have a desire to alter their consciousness, and they can do that in safe or unsafe ways, and they can have that desire in ways that are healthy and unhealthy. So we need to deal with the people who are at risk and help them find, I mean, I tend to think that if I'd been given Prozac as a kid, I might have avoided this entire thing.
Author Maya Salavitz. Danny Kushlick, head of external affairs at Transform, a British drug reform think tank. What's your perspective on what on Maya's experience? How true does that ring to you from the data?
My experience comes from my previous work as a drug counselor, working with heavy-end heroin and crack users in the criminal justice system, who brought with them many of the issues that Maya talked about earlier, that many of them had been abused, a lot of them had been in institutional care, they had low educational attainment, they had a lack of hope, and there's a lot of very good evidence to show that the kind of people who are going to really get into a mess with drugs have low levels of well-being and are, in fact, a product of societies that produce sick people. And one thing that we know, one of the interesting things in terms of the special relationship between the UK and the US is that both of us have very, very low levels of child well-being. The UNICEF league tables of child well-being always put the UK and the US at the bottom. And this is the one way that you manufacture people who are going to have a far greater propensity to misuse drugs. And I think that what we need to do here is get away from the idea of drugs being a threat to society and dealing with it through a criminalized approach, to recognizing that there are basically two groups of people who use drugs: people who use to feel good and people who use to stop feeling bad. Neither of those groups benefit in any way whatsoever from being criminalized. And we know that from criminalizing the markets, all that you do is you create massive entrepreneurial opportunities for people who don't want to pay tax, namely international organized crime and unregulated dealers. So that what this is about really is taking a step back and stopping looking at this as a drug problem, and looking at it as a societal issue that needs to be dealt with in the round.
Well, many European countries pursue more of a harm reduction policy rather than a war on drugs approach, meaning they try to minimize harm to the people who do drugs no matter what, instead of focusing just on cutting off supply. So how well do those policies and programs work in the countries that, that follow them?
Well, if we look at the countries that have really shifted the brief, if you like, from a criminal approach to a health-based approach, they've moved the brief from the Interior Ministry or the Ministry of Justice into the Health Department. They achieve much better results than those that operate on the more draconian end in terms of the criminal justice approach. So, if you look at Portugal and the Netherlands and the Czech Republic and Switzerland and Germany. They achieve much better results, but that's no surprise. This is a health issue. It's a health issue for people who use, and it's a health issue for people who misuse. And both of them need a health-based and social-based approach. So a criminal justice place is anathema for these people. All you're going to do is add pain, harm, and distress to people who are already in pain, harmed, and distressed.
Danny Kushlick with Transform, a British drug reform think tank. Mark Ryan is with the Louisiana Poison Center. How much of a concern is it for you that these policies that move away from criminalization and more towards harm reduction enable people to continue abusing?
You know, I don't really have the answer to the question, but I think one thing is kind of a highlight to me, at least here in the United States. I know there's a whole lot of options available for people who are willing to seek help. And we just moved in the United States hydrocodone, opiate pain medication, from Schedule 3, which makes the physicians able to write prescriptions with many refills, to Schedule 2, which puts much more restrictions on it. And, you know, the number of deaths from hydrocodone in this state doubled, or went from, I think, about 16,000 in 2000 to over 38,000 in 2012. And a stat that's just staggering to me for a legal drug is that over 99% of the hydrocodone produced in the world each year is consumed in the United States. So to me, legalizing these drugs seems like it's only going to compound the problem.
Well, how effective are the alternatives? And one of the big ones is public education campaigns about the dangers of these drugs.
I think education is very important. We try to do everything we can to educate from school-age children to college kids to new parents. And we're trying to get the word out there. It just seems like it's a flood right now of illegal drugs. You know, we see cocaine, we see heroin. I hate to say it, but about four blocks from where I'm sitting right now, if I drove down the road and waved a $20 bill out the street, out of the car, five people would run up to my car. They are easily available. There's places in this country where it's easier to have illicit drugs delivered to your house faster than it is to get a pizza.
And following along the playing devil's advocate to legalization, what evidence have you seen that these kinds of legal high drugs might be gateway drugs to harsher ones?
We've seen a number of centers here in Louisiana that have had a large percentage of their beds taken up by people who were using these things. I've personally discussed with the families and the people who were using it the fact that they were addicted to it. You know, we've got psychological addiction, we've got physical addiction, we've got combinations of both of those. But these are people who had been on these things for 18 to 24 months and had to go into a rehab facility to try to get themselves clean. There's stories, know of one where the person checked himself out of rehab, went and, smoked this stuff again, and they found him dead in a ditch. It's very dangerous.
Mark Ryan with the Louisiana Poison Center. Maya Salovitz, author of the forthcoming book Unbroken Brain, Why Addiction is a Learning Disorder and Why It Matters. You have written about advocates who are trying to find safer party drugs. So how safe can they be?
Well, marijuana is a pretty safe drug in terms of the fact that it's impossible to overdose on it. We have never in world history actually rationally had something like an FDA for recreational drugs. So we have no idea how safe a drug could be. We've never designed for recreational drugs because we assume that recreational drug users are deviant, not realizing that, in fact, the, you know, we all use recreational drugs. People, you know, a large majority of Americans drink alcohol, and even larger majority take caffeine. We just don't define these as drugs.
It is really interesting, though. How do you do a clinical test for new recreational drugs, and how do you test for euphoria? How much euphoria is desirable? How do you even measure it?
Well, New Zealand, there are scales for all kinds of things that you wouldn't think it would be possible to measure. But New Zealand has actually taken steps to try to do this and to try to actually create an FDA to approve safe versions of legal highs. They started with that rather than marijuana because the UN says that you cannot legalize marijuana, although now we're seeing, I was actually over there yesterday, and now we're seeing that a lot more countries are becoming much more open to interpreting the international drug conventions in a way such that it would allow countries to experiment with various versions of legalization.
So what's happening in New Zealand, this is instead of trying to keep banning these drugs as each new one crops up, you ban it. Instead of doing that, they're trying to regulate it?
Yes. So they have created an agency that oversees psychoactive substances, and they have created a network of stores to sell them, and they have been working on these questions of how do you do a clinical trial for something like this? How much do you rate euphoria? Should it have the risk of alcohol, which kills a large number of people? Should it have the risk of tobacco, which kills 50% of heavy users? With those standards, you'd approve just about anything. If you were using the standard of marijuana, though, you'd approve just about nothing. So it's really going to be interesting to see what kind of standards they develop.
Writer Maya Salovitz, Mark Ryan with the Louisiana Poison Center. What do you think of what's happening in New Zealand?
Well, you know, more is better. You know, to try different things is absolutely okay. Here in the United States, we've got, you know, the current regulations and the you know, law enforcement. That's our stick for the moment. Is it the best approach? Probably not, but it's what we've got right now. Again, I wish I had the answer.
Mark Ryan, don't we all? Director of the Louisiana Poison Center. Danny Kushlick at Transform, a British drug reform think tank. Maya Salovitz, author of the forthcoming book, Unbroken Brain. And Nicola Davison joined us earlier from Shanghai. She writes for The Guardian. I want to thank all of you very much. I appreciate it, you taking the time to talk with us today.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you.
And in a moment, last year Starbucks said it was going to help its employees get college degrees. We'll hear whether that promise has amounted to more than just hype. I'm Barbara Bogave, sitting in for Warren Olney, and this is To the Point from PRI.
Have you checked out the KCRW iPad app? It's called The Music Mine. Stream music handpicked by our DJs, watch live performances, and find new music. See why iTunes calls it an essential app for music discovery. Download and learn more at kcrw.com/musicmine.
I'm Barbara Bogave for Warren Olney with today's Talking Point. Last summer, Starbucks CEO Howard Schultz made headlines with a big promise. He announced his company would team up with Arizona State University to help Starbucks employees finish college. Starbucks got a ton of press from the announcement, but has the program lived up to its many vaulted promises of giving baristas access to the American dream? And does it have anything new to offer to the debate about how best to support people who struggle to pay for college and often fail to graduate? Amanda Ripley joins us now. Her article, The Upwardly Mobile Barista, is in this month's Atlantic Magazine. And Ripley is also the author of The Smartest Kids in the World and How They Got That Way. It's good to talk with you.
You too, Barbara. Thanks for having me.
So take us back. Remind us exactly what Starbucks and ASU promised last summer to do for these employees who want to get a college degree.
Right. Well, Starbucks had surveyed a sample of its employees and found that 80% expressed strong interest in having some more robust education benefit than what they had before, which was a basic kind of tuition reimbursement plan. And so they teamed up with Arizona State, partly because Arizona State has a pretty good record of graduating students, particularly low-income students, including online students, which is what this program would be. And so they said that students who were working at least half-time, part-time at Starbucks, could apply like anyone else and enroll, and they would be reimbursed for their tuition. And it was at first just full ride for students who already had 2 years of credits, and eventually became, they changed it and made it a full ride for any employee, regardless of how many credits you had, which, you know, was great. But the thing that I thought was much more interesting about it, and the reason we spent months following students around the country at different Starbucks, was that they were really focused on what it takes to make sure students not just start college, but finish, which is very, very unusual, not just in companies that reimburse tuition, but particularly in colleges.
And why the emphasis on that? How big a problem is that?
Well, it turns out that this is the problem. So the central challenge for Americans in the 21st century is not starting college, it's finishing it. We now have 35 million Americans who have started college and not earned a degree or certificate. And at this point, 4 out of every 10 students who enroll at a four-year college like Arizona State do not earn a degree within 6 years. So we end up with a whole class of Americans who, you know, have some credits and often significant debt, sometimes leaving them worse off than if they had taken no classes. And a lot of psychological burden sometimes about having failed at college and whether they're, you know, not going to be able to succeed if they try again. So there's a whole kind of harder to quantify impact that this failure to complete has on the country.
So way beyond tuition and harder than at first glance. So how has Starbucks delivered this first year of the program, and have they followed through on what they promised, and how have they addressed some of the issues of finishing college that you just laid out for us?
Well, it was interesting. I definitely think there were some surprises for Starbucks and for Arizona State. I mean, you know, they started out doing some very smart things to their credit. Like, they made sure that every barista who signed up had a sort of pit crew of support staff, essentially, to help not only with tuition, but help make sure that they succeeded. You know, a lot of first-generation college students don't have a huge number of people cheering them on, telling them that they can succeed, who also graduated from college. And they do have people telling them that they're wasting their money, and they do have very little time and very little cash. So what the research has found is that just a little bit of support, feeling like someone's in your corner, whether it's a financial aid advisor or an academic advisor, or what Starbucks in Arizona State also supplied what they call a success coach who kind of keeps in regular touch with you, that kind of thing turns out to be not super expensive and actually very impactful on helping make sure students finish. So that, I think, was a smart move, and they ended up just increasing that support over time. One surprise was that, you know, they had a really hard time convincing their employees that this was real. I think we've maybe gotten ourselves in a situation in this country where college has a very bad brand. I mean, people are suspicious, not just of college, but also of corporations, and rightfully so. And they had to do a lot of work to convince their 135,000 employees that, you know, they really were going to pay for it, and they really could succeed if they tried and they could manage it all. So they had far fewer people sign up at first than they had anticipated, which I think was a surprise to them. And, you know, to their credit, they've done a bunch of things to try to improve that rate over time.
Well, you talk to a lot of students about their struggle to pay for school, and this whole debate in America about college education is mostly in the realm of how much tuition costs. But it sounds like a big part of the problem is this support, and also for students is that they didn't know what kind of debt they were getting into, a kind of financial bind and illiteracy at work there.
Right. I mean, there was a recent study that found that about half of college freshmen don't actually understand the loans that they have. And, you know, it's easy for us to say, oh, you know, they're clueless, you know, 18-year-olds, which, by the way, most of them are not, but not 18. But actually, you know, the way we do financial aid in this country is very confusing, and it's not user-friendly. You don't actually know how much you're going to have to pay from 1 year to the next. So you're being asked to make a major, major investment without knowing the total price point. You have to keep reapplying for financial aid each year. The financial aid form has 105 items, which it doesn't need to have. You know, it's kind of like doing your taxes. And then once you get to college, dealing with the bureaucracy at many, many American colleges is like dealing with the DMV. I mean, it is not pleasant. You have to wait for hours to see someone. You have to really be very aggressive and have a lot of free time and confidence to kind of find your way through the bureaucracy. There's a whole bunch of students who are taking classes they don't need and don't realize it. You know, we have a lot of a lot of waste in an industry that really can't anymore justify that kind of waste.
Well, online learning, though, is a big part of this Starbucks program, and that's ASU's emphasis. It also keeps costs down because there's a question of how sustainable a program like this is with all of this support. So, but it all depends on how well online learning works. And what's the data on that and the consensus?
Right. No, you're right. It all depends on how it's done, and it's changing really fast. So, you know, 5 years ago or so, I did a story where I took some online classes for the piece, and it looks very different now than it looked then. And it depends, obviously, on the program. But some programs are finding they can have pretty good success rates, in some cases even better than bricks and mortar classes. A lot depends on the students. I mean, you know, you do need a level of self-discipline and organization and drive in order to succeed online. I don't think there's any way around that. But the reality is we now have so many adults who are working and sometimes, you know, taking care of family members, and they're going to be going online. So we can just, you know, romanticize the American grassy quad of yore, which never really existed, or we can just sort of say, let's find programs that actually work. And one of the pieces that really seems to work with the online programs and on-the-ground programs is this kind of coaching and support and, you know, just kind of a baseline level of customer service that we come to expect in a lot of our spending, but not in education.
And we've come to expect from Starbucks. So is that the upshot just in the last 20 seconds of our conversation, that this program works and could provide a model for others, that it's sustainable?
So far, so good. 87% of the 1,000 baristas who enrolled in the first semester re-upped for the second semester, which is an early indicator of success. That is pretty good for an online program. But, you know, we'll see what happens. I think the most promising thing is that Starbucks and Arizona State keep changing what they're doing to make it better, which, again, is very unusual in the state.
And you can read Amanda Ripley's article, The Upwardly Mobile Barista, in this month's Atlantic. Well, thank you so much for this.
Thank you very much.
And that's all we have, all the time we have for you today. To the Point was produced this week by Andrea Brody, Katie Cooper, Christine Detz, Benjamin Gottlieb, Jenny Hamill, and Sasha Woodruff. Our technical directors are Mike Newport and Joel Stein, and our managing producer is Evan George. Thanks also to the John Coltrane family. I'm Barbara Bogave, in for Warren Olney, and Warren will be back with you on Monday. I hope you all have a wonderful weekend. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
Public Radio International.